Good afternoon. Welcome to the weekly show. As always, we're live from the back garden of DBA here in lovely East Village, New York, New York. We're here today to talk about mostly what you want to talk about, and a little bit of what we want to talk about. But we're using Sean Van Every, who's behind the controls, his interactive telejournalism platform to broadcast live over the web, and hopefully you guys are chatting as well in the chat room, asking us questions, and let's try to have a conversation today. Welcome, Eli.
Yeah, I'm Eli Chapman. This is Dan Mellinger. You may recognize us from such blogs as unmediated.org, and we're also on the video blogging group and our own blogs. I'm at chapmanlogic.com. Dan is at bionicdan.net. And until we get some questions, I thought one thing that I was posting to Unmediated today about that I thought would be worth talking about is the trend that we're moving towards an IT-based camcorder. So you have, on one hand, you have camera phones and wireless devices that have built-in imaging and audio and the ability to make short MPEG clips and send that over the network. You have traditional DV camcorders, which are getting cheaper and reducing in size while increasing in quality. And today there was actually an announcement from Texas Instruments that their new DSP chip is going to have embedded onto it software from Object Video, which is, they make video analysis software for surveillance. So what it does is it allows you to look at an image, say, of a bus station, and if there's anything irregular, you can set up rules basically to say, if someone lingers for 30 seconds and then leaves a bag or an object and then leaves the frame, then that will be recognized and an alarm is sent and someone can go check it out.
So what kind of devices would that be embedded in?
Well, right now it's being embedded into camcorders. That's the plan, into video cameras. It's currently being used just as network software so that you have a bunch of CCTV or networked video cameras, and all of those feeds are getting sent to a server, and those feeds are being processed by the software individually, and it takes up quite a bit of network resources to do that. By embedding it on the chip, what you're doing is you're reducing the load on the server, and you're actually just getting the job done much faster. So the idea is to have chips and camcorders that have built-in content analysis, basically. So when you think about speech to text, for example, and some of the work that companies like StreamSage are doing, that's not so far out of reach to have something that's embedded into a camcorder that could actually be doing this live while you're shooting. You get transcripts made. On the video analysis side, you can have facial recognition, or you can have object recognition, like a birthday cake or a location or whatever it might be.
Did the announcement talk about what kinds of applications, what kind of metadata that this chip might be able to grab from the video?
Yeah, it's mostly having to do for surveillance with object tracking and what's been referred to by some companies as blob tracking. So you can see patterns of movement by individual and set up rules that say if the pattern deviates from this path on the XY axis, then send out an alarm.
It's clearly a step towards bringing the annotation of media to the mobile device. Whether or not this is the chip that's going to be in consumer devices, and whether or not Texas Instruments is the one to do it, it's clearly a milestone.
Well, the TI chips are used in a lot of the consumer devices. It's just that the they did an OEM agreement, I think, with Object Video to embed their software onto the DSP chip. So, yeah, if you guys have any questions about the path towards an IT-based camcorder, because I think that's really key for video blogging. It's really key for the success of a decentralized peer-to-peer media environment, because you don't have a way to capture it quickly, put it on the network with the context of what you're doing, without having to edit and log and digitize, etc. And with mobile devices, you have the ability to send a little clip, but the context of that clip is missing. So
let's talk about a bit about what that means to be an IP enabled camcorder? What are the requirements? What kind of functionality does that need to have? Because I mean, from what I see, and let me know if you think you know we're on the same page. It's basically you need a media capture device. In a camcorder, you need a CCD chip or something like that to capture images. You need to capture audio as well. But then you need that to probably be connected to some sort of storage medium that is easily that you can easily move around on.
Mm-hmm.
Not a tape, but mm-hmm. something like either flash storage,
or
flash memory,
disk,
or a hard drive. Mm-hmm. And then you need connectivity to a network.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the internet or a private network,
mm-hmm.
and whether it's over Wi-Fi or GPRS or IDEN or whatever.
Sure.
And then processing on top of that is what we're talking about today with this add-on to DSP chips.
Yeah, and you have, you know, the idea is if you can write software for a camcorder, if you can, say you're doing a documentary about, the election right now. If you could load onto that camcorder the information that's relevant to what you're shooting, sort of the names of the candidates, the names of the issues, and you can talk to people about those issues, and the camcorder can recognize when a certain issue is being talked about, then your video just automatically gets cataloged and organized in such a way where video blogging makes sense. Then you can just say, when you're done shooting, let's say you want to look up everything having to do with healthcare. It's just a category or search. It's a click. It's not edit, and upload, etc.
Right.
Then you're talking about a system that you've got a language that you can work from.
And that's whether or not you are the initiator, the one who created that content, or behind the person that created that content. If you could be just some guy who has access to that video. Say that video was released under a more open license, such as Creative Commons or something. Okay,
just to bring it back again, and feel free to interrupt and ask anything about anything really having to do with media technology. I saw some interesting things today, and I posted some Mediated about how there's a definite path right now towards the IT-based camcorder. And what I mean is, instead of having tape-based electronic devices to capture video, you have little computers, which you can see with mobile phones, except with more computational power. So the idea is, when you're capturing your video, you're capturing more than just audio and video. You're capturing the context of what you're shooting, and you're capturing based on the intent of what you want to capture. So in a sense, it's able to help record what's in your head while you're shooting, so that you don't need to do as much editing and organizing and logging. It's just all put out there in front of you in the way that you want it to be. It makes it easier to use video as a means of communication, and makes it easier to collaborate together and tell stories or express ideas.
Right. So for someone approaching that media after the fact, after that media has been collected, it's much easier to approach that media, whether it be just to search it for one's just direct knowledge or enjoyment, or whether it is to edit a larger piece together. And whether that person is the initial creator of the media or a third party who has access to that media, they're able to take that media much easier. It's already cataloged, so mm-hmm. they can already search through it and repurpose it in any number of ways.
I mean, you just have the basic scenario of how do you search through your video? How do you find the media that you want? How do you look through the media on the web? Why isn't there media on the web? Well, it's not searchable. It's not easy to get out there. So an IT-based camcorder with intelligent software that can help log and organize it according to an individual's intent just makes the whole web-based video world possible.
So I don't see any other questions, but I did want to talk a little bit about what kind of forms these devices are going to take and who's actually going to be using them in the next couple of years. We already, I think, over the last couple of weeks have seen, and over the last couple of months and years, have seen news teams talking about going toward hard drive-based mm-hmm. Video recorders.
Sure.
And that is certainly a step in that direction, and that's more on the professional side. After news teams, we can certainly see other types of television shows. I mean, it would make a lot of sense, I would think, for reality television.
Yeah, documentary.
And documentaries, there's just mm-hmm. so much footage being captured by so many different people. It's very related to time, very related to location,
mm-hmm.
very related to the people in the frame,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Sure.
There's so much to go through. And then on the other side, I'd like to talk a little bit more about stuff that's more accessible, prosumer stuff and the consumer stuff. I know on the consumer side, there's I don't know of any hard drive based video recorders, though there are some flash memory video recorders.
There's okay. A couple that have just come out, but Sony released one a few years ago that wasn't very successful. It was kind of big and bulky. It wasn't very useful, and it was very expensive. Actually, what you're seeing now on the prosumer side is augmenting of the cameras with hard drives that capture into the format for editing, so you don't have to digitize, basically.
Right, so plug a device into the FireWire cable of your video camera and capture it at the same time.
Yes.
And that fulfills, like, one of the requirements, but not the network connectivity. So it's still, separated that way, and also not the the processing side. But you are one step towards things, putting stuff on a hard drive, easier to move around, navigate that media.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, the RNC coming into New York City, and you just think about how many people were shooting media. I mean, it's unbelievable. You're talking about 1,000 to 5,000 cameras, probably, camcorders. And then who knows how many digital cameras and camera phones. And yet there's not a great aggregation of that media. On the other hand, you have Flickr, which does a good job of aggregating those photos. So you can do a search for the RNC tag on Flickr, and you will find a whole bunch of photos having to do with the RNC. Hmm. But you're not going to find video that's like that. So yeah, the idea is if the camera is recording the time and the location, and then there's an understanding that that's when the RNC is, because it's in New York and it's on this date, then everything's automatically tagged with that, and then you start to be able to get to an aggregation of all of that media, and then you can start to reuse it and edit and mix it and share it and communicate using it. We got a question from Seaweagle. How would we cope with competing standards? Well, I think that... Are you asking standards in terms of video formats?
I guess other than video formats, it could be standards in terms of the metadata formats.
Let's see if he gets back.
Follow up on that question.
I mean, in terms of video formats, I think you've got MPEG as a great standard that people are using, and then you can just assume it's easy to make real QuickTime or Windows Media or whatever is the flavor of the year. MPEG-2 is the standard for broadcast television and for DVD, so that's a good start. MPEG-4 is moving towards the broadcast realm as well, and even digital cinema is going to happen in MPEG-2. So that is a standard that people are using.
And there are also some standards for ways of embedding data into MPEG format as well, right?
Well, there's MPEG-7 and MPEG-21. MPEG-7 is a metadata format for annotation, describing the context of the video. MPEG-21 is a metadata standard for the usage of video and the history of usage and sort of sales or whatever might be around that video. But then you also have standards that have formed in the broadcast industry, like AAF, the Advanced Authoring Format, and MXF, the Material Exchange Format. Those are both used by broadcasters to exchange between different editing systems and effect systems and keep track of the life cycle of a media asset and all the different components that go into telling a linear story so that you can go back and adjust things and make new assets.
Josh asked whether MPEG metadata is searchable.
Well, MPEG-7 is definitely searchable. I mean, you can basically have an MPEG-7 compliant database and... It's basically like XML, and you can search by fields or by objects within the video or colors or movement. I mean, there's all sorts of fields within the MPEG-7 standard.
From what I've read and learned, it seems like the issue of standards is less an issue in terms of the technical standards for how that metadata is stored and more an issue of how that metadata might be shared. I mean, right now, the only ways this types of stuff is being used is on closed production teams or production teams that might, include freelancers, but everyone's working on the same project. What happens? How do we open it up to a wider audience? How do we allow, can we think about creating a standard so that everyone has access to the data in a similar sort of way, whether it be, you know, through the internet or through peer-to-peer, you know, through the web or through peer-to-peer or
I think that if you have let's say you have annotation that's metadata that's being collected on the device or on the desktop and then sent over the network, I mean, look at Flickr. You can build an interface to that metadata, which is standardized, and open up that API so that people can build tools on top of it. Mm. And I think that's a good path for it.
So let's slow down a little bit and mention what H.264 is and MPEG 7 and MPEG
21. Sure.
Sean just had a few comments.
Yeah, just to talk again, H.264, which Daniel just asked to explain. I mean, I'm not the expert on H.264, but I do know it's a codec being used for video conferencing. For the most part, it actually got a lot of it had a lot of success in Hollywood, being used to deliver digital dailies from a production set to the location. So, for example, a lot of film shoots happen in Vancouver, and then the studio is down in LA, and they want to see what happened that day. So they'll make H.264 of the video, stream it down. Sean just said it's a variant of MPEG 4. It's basically a high quality, low resolution. High resolution but low bitrate format, so it's easy to send over a network. But it's basically just another codec. MPEG 7 is a metadata standard. It doesn't have to do with video at all in terms of the actual codec that's being used for compression. Let's see, any other questions?
There's some technical problems on the video side. Sean looks to be working assiduously at correcting them.
Yeah, well...
So hopefully we'll get the video out, but do you really need to see our faces?
What is MPEG 21?
MPEG 21 is, again, it's a metadata standard, but also for interaction with video and for the consumption of video, so that you can track usage and things like... measure the value of a piece of content and measure and see how people have interacted with that content. I'm not an expert on MPEG 21, but that's how I understand it, to what the standard has been formed to be. And I think it is a finalized standard at this point, MPEG 21. Hmm. But yeah, there's only a few commercial applications using MPEG 7 at this point. And I don't think there's any using MPEG 21. But in the broadcast industry and even in consumer video, I think MPEG 2 and MPEG 4 are going to be the leading standards that we end up using. And things like Flash Video or QuickTime or Windows Media are just going to be transcoded from that, just to make it easy to share over a network or to make it easy in case people don't have the right players to play. Well, again, this is the Unmediated Weekly Show, and we're here at DBA in the East Village, and we're having some technical problems, but we're basically here to talk about participatory media. We're still trying to iron out what the show is going to be, and we'd love for some feedback as to what you think it should be and how you want it to happen, who you want to have on, what kind of things you want to talk about. We're just sort of testing out the system now and seeing if it's going to work and just putting it out there and seeing what people think.
Right on.
Invite anyone in the
Zoom
audience now to join us.
Yeah, Kenyatta just said that he's hearing a lot more engineers talk about MPEG 4 and 7, a lot less about MPEG 2 nowadays. Yeah, I mean, it's...
It's an improvement, right? MPEG 2.
As MPEG 4 becomes, the encoding becomes faster and faster and higher quality, then it can replace MPEG 2. I mean, you're talking about the ability to put two or three times the amount of the length of video on a DVD, for example, using MPEG 4 instead of MPEG 2. And MPEG 2 doesn't have any metadata. I mean, there's some metadata associated, but MPEG 7 can work with MPEG 2 or MPEG 4. But yeah, I think the move towards MPEG 4 will happen. It seems to be that there's a lot of new applications and new uses for it. There's a company called Akimbo, A-K-I-M-B-O, I think, that has a set-top box that they sell to consumers, and you can buy it, and basically it's like it's private cable television network, except it's not over cable, it's over IP, I think you pay $200 for the box and some $20 a month, and they've licensed a lot of content, and they deliver everything over MPEG 4.
What about Netflix and...
Netflix, I don't know.
Netflix had made an agreement with somebody.
Oh, sure, Netflix and TiVo, yeah. They'll probably be using MPEG 4 as well. Daniel just asked, MPEG 4 seems to be much better for re-importing back into an NLE since it doesn't seem to be so darn muxy. Well, actually, MPEG 2 wouldn't be muxed unless it's on a DVD. But both of them aren't so great to go back to a NLE because they have GOPs, groups of pictures, to help with the compression. So
in other words, non-linear editing system.
Yeah, into a non-linear editing system. So you've got a situation where most non-linear editing systems need to work with what's called iframe-only video, which means every single frame has a reference point, so that if you decide to make an edit from point A to point B, that when it goes to start that new clip, it knows what that frame is. The problem with MPEG 2 and MPEG 4 often is that you have what are called groups of pictures. So in 14 frames, for example, you'll have one frame, the first and the 14th frame will be real frames, and then everything else is just sort of an interpolation from the frame before it. So in other words, the picture of us right now, there'd be an iframe to show Dan and I sitting here. Then for the next 14 frames, just our hands moving or the leaves behind us would be the new information. So it reduces the amount of information, and that's how it compresses. So when you do that, if you cut in between the group of pictures, it's slow. It has to create a new iframe. But editing companies like Pinnacle and Avid and Sony and Thomson Multimedia, they're all dealing with that, and they're coming out with solutions for it. But the problem with it, if you bring MPEG 4 and MPEG 2 into an NLE today, you have to transcode it usually into the NLE's special video format, which is usually DV or Motion JPEG or iframe only MPEG 2, and that can take a long time, and it's not an easy thing to do. So,
Daniel, we're hoping to launch the Bitron Tracker web community within a month for public access TV distribution. He should talk to Drazen. Maybe you guys could explain a little bit about some of the things that Drazen is thinking about.
You want to talk about that?
Sure.
We have a problem with Felicia, is it?
Okay, we mentioned it briefly last week, but Drazen, one of the projects he's been working on for, I think it's probably been about 2 years now, is something called DV Guide, allowing people to easily create BitTorrent trackers and a BitTorrent seed at a centralized location, with a decent amount of bandwidth, so that seed can work okay. It's still kind of in test mode. They've made some improvements over the last couple months. It's not getting a whole lot of use from what I see, but it's out there and working. So if you want to go out and test with it and mess around with it, that's what it's there for. And it's also there if you have something you really want to distribute. It's a public system that's accessible to anyone. Throw up your video, throw up your media, anything you want to create a BitTorrent seed of. And I'd be really curious to hear what you guys are, what Daniel and Kenyatta are up to in terms of that stuff, and how it might complement what Drazen's been doing. Anything else, Drazen, that you're aware of that Drazen's been doing in that realm? What's that?
The physical device. Daniel's looking at the
physical device.
Yeah, we were talking about a physical device when Unmediated first formed with Kenyatta, Cheese, and Dan Mellinger here, me and Sean Van Avery and Drazen and Kevin Lakota. We were talking about building a physical device that would just basically let you plug your camera into it and send that out and basically make a BitTorrent file of your video feed and send that out over the network peer-to-peer to other devices like that. We thought that would be a nice distribution solution for NGOs, nonprofits, independent media artists, and just individuals in general. So we talked about it, but we haven't built it yet.
Yeah, I mean, we're still pursuing that a bit, and it might not be something that's sold as a device. It might be a set of specifications and a package of software that can be installed on that specified type of device.
We have a request from Yada to talk about video distribution through sites like DV Guide, versus program channel distribution. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about peer-to-peer distribution versus broadcast, where it's one-to-many or just one-to-one, small group to small group. And, yeah, with a site like DV Guide, you have a situation where the media doesn't even have to be hosted there. Lots of individuals can be downloading clips to each other, basically, and you're eliminating the middleman. I mean, you're in a situation where if you make a program and you want it to go out somewhere, you don't have to get distribution anymore. You can just put it out on the web as a reference to the media, and as people download it, the more people that download it, the easier it's going to be to spread throughout the internet and throughout the network.
Right. There are some hurdles that need to be jumped over. One of those is, how do we inform people about that media? In program channel distribution, the traditional way has been people have sort of a quasi community around a channel. People know to go to a channel at a certain time for a certain show, or they know to go to a certain channel for a certain type of viewpoint or for a certain type of show. And then there's TV Guide, there's media metadata available to find out about what's going to be on that channels. And then there's with digital cable, there's electronic program guides and the easy ability to browse through listings on a program channel. What we need to create is a very easy way, and people are certainly working on creating it now, to browse this this media that's distributed in a less structured form.
Right, and you have a situation like Kenyatta's pointing out, individual clips that aren't curated or programmed. What you're talking about being able to do with something like DV Guide and just better metadata about the video on a network is you can start to link to things. You can start to reference them and put them together and build playlists. And an individual can go in and say, these are the things I'm interested in. Then I can go and say, I like this clip. I like this video. And I can see, oh, this person likes this video too. And here's all the other videos this person likes. And then I look at those videos and I say, wow, look at all these other people who like these videos too.
Right.
And I mean, look, it's like blog rolling with blogs. I mean, when you look at the side of a blog, when I first got involved in blogging, I went to one blog. It was camworld.com, actually. And I looked at Cameron Barrett's blog roll, and I just clicked through every single one and just couldn't believe the kind of people that were out there on the web. And I was blown away. And it made me feel like I was part of a community. People were talking about things that I was thinking about. And when that starts to happen with video, it's going to be really exciting because it will inspire participation, which is really the critical component of what will be a future participatory medium for all of us to communicate and entertain each other with and educate each other with. The ability to link, to reference, to comment, to have conversations in this medium. And I think that it starts with the decentralized access and then the ability to link and refer. And of course, as we talked about earlier, the ability to create good metadata around that video.
So channels have traditionally acted as gatekeepers, and they've acted as filters, which is a great thing because you know who to go to for a certain viewpoint or for a certain type of media. You know, but they've also created really large barriers to entry. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, and one of the things that we need to be careful of, RSS is being seen as a sort of moving the channel metaphor over into the web space. You subscribe to an RSS feed instead of subscribing to a cable channel. And Eli is talking about some of the ways how you could use communities and things that other people like in order to find what you might like. The end goal here, though, is watching quality media that is quality to you, and not what is, what someone else thinks might be good for you. I think the holy grail is like the creation of these really smart filters that knows what I want to see. And so anything that works towards that is going to, help in that endeavor and that end goal. And one of the best filters is social filters, knowing what someone who I agree with or who I, enjoy watching media from likes. First of all, what they've produced and then what they like. But the key is get that quality media through, get stuff that people want to see, even if the person, you know, it's their first time producing something, they don't have a lot of cred. But if they have a great piece, it's going to rise to the top. If they have an okay piece, it's going to take some time for them to build up the credibility to get to the top. You can look at an analogy like eBay ratings. How much do you trust a person? And that's in the realm of commerce. Mm-hmm. But everyone has a sort of
sure.
rating there. And the higher your number, the more I can probably trust you. And then I can browse and learn a little bit about your past and
sure.
stuff like that. And another analogy is Slashdot mm-hmm. and the way they work their community.
Mm-hmm.
And people get credibility based on their past and then their community moderators. But the key is, I think we're going to need to take bits and pieces from the channel metaphor, RSS, from eBay, the ratings, from Slashdot, the channel moderators,
mm-hmm.
and maybe hopefully some artificial intelligence type filtering
mm-hmm.
That goes through the metadata automatically, knows what you kind of like. And from all of that, we got to figure out a way to, you know, once you get what you got, what's good for you, get it to the right people, and get it to them when they want to watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, all those things. I mean, you can look at blogging and just the natural sort of reputation system that's emerged out of, you know, just how many posts is it, how long has a person been blogging, how often do they post, how many comments do they get, you know, where are they on Technorati, or Blogdex or whatever it might be. Yeah, the reputation system is key. But again, I always come back to the production side where you have a situation like, you're talking about a world where there's already lots of video online,
mm-hmm.
where there's people who are able to tell stories and express themselves using video in a way where it's not happening yet. And so there's a gap between the feasibility of Flickr TV and this ability to make playlists and have BitTorrent closures and downloading your channels that you're liking and meeting with these communities of interest around certain around media, and then just making a small video and putting it on the web that's relevant and building an audience around that. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, the idea of IT-based camcorders. There's got to be a lot of work done on the production side to solve those problems, because we can see that the reputation and the social side of it works already. It's already working with text and with photos because of things mm-hmm. like Flickr. So
Video is a different paradigm, though, and the way that people consume video is different, and I'm always keen to see, and I'd love for people to send out their feelings and stuff that they've seen about how watching a video webcast on your computer, like probably most of you out there are, is different from sitting on your couch and watching video, because I think there are some key differences there.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, it may not be as easy to chat, which is a negative. But maybe, I don't know, I know I have Wi-Fi in my apartment, and I'd be happy to watch it on the TV and chat on my computer at the same time. But one of my big questions is, how can we design around those different consumption models? And how can we tailor these systems that we're going to build to these consumption models?
Yeah.
I think browsing is going to be very different. You don't walk around and spend a lot of time. You want things brought to you more, I think. And there's also, when you sit back on the couch, there is some sort of a relaxation mode. We're getting into that psychology of it all. But
right.
There's some sort of a relaxation mode that we go into. And someone watching this for, you know, they're very, you know, the immediate weekly show, I think we're all really interested in the technology. We want to be a part of it and so on and so forth. But mm-hmm. when you're watching, you know, a bit of homegrown reality television, you might also want to be sitting back on your couch, watching with a couple friends,
mm-hmm.
talking about it at the same time,
mm-hmm.
maybe interacting a bit. And that's a different paradigm, and it needs different technology and different sorts of
creativity. One of the biggest problems is that these are creative problems. I mean, these are not, a lot of what we're not technical problems, but creative problems. There's going to be a new kind of artist, or whatever you want to call them, skilled at making participatory media. And what participatory media, it's a framework for interaction and experience between a group of people in something that they want to communicate on. And until there's many people trying to do that and successful implementations of it, then the medium can't evolve. So yeah, there's the technology exists, but there's also the problem of, you know, what is this medium going to look like, and why are people going to participate in it? And it's not just going to be little clips of video like we're talking about. It's going to be something different, something more social, something that's more relevant to those people. And yeah, like you were saying, that it's not a lean back experience. I think that's critical. In fact, I would go as far to say that what we're going to see is the emergence of a generation of people who consume media only for the sake of participating and producing. So when you go to watch and consume media, what you're doing is you're really just figuring out what to do next. You're just getting some information in this sort of non-linear quest that you're on, mm-hmm. as an audience member or as a participant. So you're not in a situation anymore where you're just going to be, you know, laying back and watching. Of course, that'll still exist. Mm-hmm. And there'll be, but what you'll see is Hollywood will get bigger and bigger. You'll have more of a IMAX type experience where it's full virtual reality embodiment. Mm-hmm. Gaming will become also like that, but you'll see this new medium emerging, which is going to be a lot like gaming, actually, where you have these persistent worlds that exist between communities and between friends, mm. where they're able to explore ideas and just make things which are really fun. And in the meantime, there'll still be a spillover into traditional media, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's pretty exciting.
I think we also do need to keep in mind that traditional media was created, or television at least, and a lot of radio, at least in this country, is commercially supported, and it's designed to make you want to sit back on that couch, mm-hmm. and that might not necessarily be the optimal thing for those viewers to be doing, but content and television are for the advertising,
yeah.
right? And the more they can get you to sit on the couch and watch back and sit back and watch,
yeah.
The more for the advertisers. But even that is changing. Advertisers are moving to more sorts of experiential advertising, games that are, you know, that become advertising, getting people to participate and, you know, post to a blog that has to do with, mm-hmm. you know, some sort of commercial message.
Mm-hmm.
And as media hopefully comes a little more from the bottom up, the models would be more based on purely the optimal ways to consume media, and less based on purely the goals of the commercial enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at television or even Hollywood, I mean, the goal is just simply to brand in your mind a feeling, so that when advertising hits you, you're susceptible to it.
Hmm.
In film, the goal is simply to get you to come to the movie theater, or get you to go buy the DVD or rent the movie. That's it. I mean, I had a film professor who said, if you're going to go to film school, if you're going to be a chef, why would you? And he was talking about, if you're going to go to film school and learn how to make movies, why would you study Hollywood? You don't want to study the most successful movies, because that's McDonald's. You want to study the small, homegrown, most wonderful cuisine, so to speak, in the field.
Unless you want to make money.
Sure, but then you should be in the marketing program or the business school instead of in an arts program. Or
a lot of Hollywood does seem like they're just in the marketing program, so to speak.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, but this is exciting, because when you look at film, you know, Hollywood and the last 100 years of film in America, you know, 99% of what's come out is really just 1% of what's possible. What's possible with film, as people get access to equipment and distribution, we'll see, I think, small theaters start to emerge, like a Starbucks-type movie house, you know, or even just a home theater environment, where there's this great global network of people who are probably young people who are making these interesting stories and sharing them with each other. And it's not just about that one story. It's about this continuous evolution of thought and idea and communication, where I make something because of what you made and because of what they made, and then they're all reacting and we're all working together to do something, mm-hmm. and to have fun with this, and, you know, maybe even that's how we make a living.
I think that this probably plays a bit into why there's so much resistance for movie theaters going digital, having DLP projectors and movie distribution going over, you know, the internet or closed networks. Mm-hmm. They're scared if they open those gates and make it technologically feasible that that anyone can get in there and it'll no longer be Hollywood possibly. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I've been following it a bit, and they always throw out the excuse, oh, but a DLP projector is what, like half $200,000, something like that per theater.
Mm-hmm.
But the distribution costs are astronomical for reels of film.
And the reproduction.
And it seems to me obvious that even just over, you know, a 10-year sort of loan from the bank or whatever, they could really they could make their money back.
Well, I mean, actually, satellite companies like Motorola or Qualcomm, I mean, was willing to pay for theaters to get that. Mm-hmm. So it's not even the cost. And actually, I disagree with you in some way because if you look at, you know, this is a capitalist society, so you have small movie theaters are willing to do things that are anti-Hollywood if they can make money.
Right.
Like, for example, with the Fish concert, the last Fish show, the band, was broadcast via satellite into, I don't know how many theaters, but I think it was over Landmark Theaters, and people went in for a six-hour Fish concert, and, you know, they're starting to do that with soccer games, soccer matches, and concerts and live events. That's not Hollywood. It's a new thing. It's
right.
A new way for the theater to make money, and people like it. It's a sign of the fragmentation of Hollywood's access to that distribution medium, and it's going to open up for us. If you can walk into a theater and you can say, hey, I can get sold out shows for 3 weeks, they'll give you a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you might have to pay a little bit and then you'll get your money back, but that exists today, and in the future it's going to even be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was a bit playing the pessimist, but I think it also you said that small chains, and I don't know, I don't have the figures in front of me, but I don't think those are the majority of screens out there. I think the majority of screens out there are owned by large chains that are even more in bed with the production houses. And hopefully this is the way that it's going to work. I mean, start with the small chains, and then, you know, once these larger chains see that how profitable it is, they're going to have to jump on the bandwagon.
Well, they're not even small chains. I mean, these are large chains.
Landmark, these are big companies.
But, mm-hmm. You know, the key is, again, these are capitalist companies. They want to make money. If they can make more money by showing three versions of Titanic in one theater, they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, yeah, I mean, the economics are changing, and we'll see what happens, especially because now you've got all the media being released at once. So you've got DVD, you've got, you know, the web. What show? Something recently just came out.
The WB show. Is that what you're going to talk
yeah,
about?
Yeah, there was a WB show released on TV.
Yeah,
on the web
my wife got it in the mail. And she got it. It was released on the web, but I also got a DVD.
Wow.
I think included with my subscription to New York Times.
Huh.
Jack and Bobby, something like
okay,
that.
Okay.
WB show. I don't know. I didn't watch the DVD, but I thought it was amazing. You know, I'm like, holy crap! I'm getting a TV show over DVD.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just exactly what we're talking about, just embracing these alternative methods of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
It's because with hundreds of channels of cable, the chances that you're going to switch to the WB for a show that you've never seen before is lower. But if you get a DVD in the mail, oh, I've got a DVD,
right.
You know, and DVDs have some inherent value in the mind of the consumer. I don't know why it's any more valuable than turning on the television, watching a channel, but there's something special about having that physical media.
Well, actually, DVDs have a lot of value. If you think about it compared to a magazine, you don't throw them away.
Yep.
You know, you don't put them in the bathroom.
Yep.
You know, the DVDs, they have more value than a magazine.
I wish I could put them in the bathroom.
What's Mark Cuban working on?
Well, Mark Cuban has, actually, kind of interesting. He's got, Yada just mentioned three screens of Titanic is a problem of capacity seats. Well, it's also a creation of demand. A lot of people go to the movie theater without knowing what they're going to see, and they're just like, what should we see tonight? And they go see a movie. So I don't know if that's true, that there's so many people who want to see the movie that they have to have three screens.
I think it's still a difference between an event movie and just a going to the movie sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, in terms of Mark Cuban has a company called HDNet, and he also, I think they are the primary investor or owner of Landmark, or some theater chain. I'm not positive which one. Maybe someone can look that up. But yeah, HDNet is basically an HD TV network. They do a lot of sports and just anything that involves high quality imagery, something that looks beautiful. And I don't know too much about it because I don't have HD and I haven't seen too much of it. But the fact that he's got the theater chain is exciting because he's seeing the future. He's seeing how you could have a situation where there's multiple distribution points. You're doing it all at once, and he's talked about on his blog at blogmaverick.com the opportunity of basically giving people huge hard drives full of HD for them to watch media at home, and then sort of refreshing them. He talks about how bandwidth is going to always be a problem because HD is so huge. I don't know.
It's not a problem in Korea. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, talk about that.
I've been researching it a bunch lately because I'm going to Korea in about 2 weeks now for a conference called the International Conference. Hold on, I gotta fix my wire here. International Conference on Mobile Technology and Social Change. And I wrote an abstract paper and applied to it with a friend of mine, Mike Sharon. So we're going to this thing, and I'm doing a ton of research on Korea, and it's amazing, as I was saying last week, how little information is coming back to us about what they're doing over there. But of all places where I found like some of the richest information about what's going on in the broadband world over there is from Fortune magazine, last week's Fortune, had an article called "There's the Broadband Dreams" or something like that, and it's just it's in part because of the government is pushing for it, in part because of the small size of Korea, also because of the way buildings are laid out. They're new buildings, tall buildings. Everyone lives very closely together. But anyway, they've been able to wire people for broadband at amazing, amazing rates. And for the cost of a cable modem connection here, you can get a 20 megabit connection to the internet there. And that is more than enough for sending HD TV around. And you could send a stream live from one person to another person with no problem at all. And in fact, I met someone, I've been trying to pick people's brains about Korea, and if anyone has any advice, let me know. But I met a woman at a bar the other night, and she was from Seoul, and she had just gotten back. And her friends were amazed when they said, "Hey, I watched this great TV the other night. I'm going to send you the file." And she just goes and sends a 3 gigabyte file to the girl. And she's like, "I can't receive this because I'm back in the States now." And she was just amazed because that's the way of life there. It's become normal. And people are very technologically savvy, and it's a difference between there and here. But it's amazing. With this extra bandwidth, they've used it very, very quickly. They find ways to use it. Many, many people have digital video recorders at home. They have very high penetration of that. People have upgraded their PCs a lot faster than they do here just to get, you know, the capabilities to work with video much more easily. TVs there are connected to computers a lot more than they're connected straight to the, you know, cable boxes. They're connected to more.
We have a question. Sean's asking if they use this for their own media. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know a lot about that, and it's one of the things I'm going to try to learn. I'm going to try to research when I'm there. I know that people are using camera phones to capture media a lot, and video conferencing over camera phones is a very normal occurrence. They don't talk about the penetration of picture phones there. They talk about the penetration of video phones, which is higher than the penetration of picture phones here. And they use that to create short messages, send them around to their friends, stuff like that. But I don't know about, you know, richer media. But I'm
like
certainly
the independent
curious to learn
film
about
scene,
that.
For example.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it just makes me excited to think about it. But
I'm
gonna try to learn about that.
But I personally think that, so assume that we lived here in the U.S. I don't know if anyone's online who's not from the U.S. But assume that we had these, what is it, 10 gig bandwidth?
20 gig is normal, and I think you can pay a little more for even.
So say we had 20 gig up and down everywhere we go, right?
20 megabit. Not
20
gigabit,
megabit.
Yeah.
Right, say we had 20 megabit. Actually, 20 gigabit is what
nice.
Satellites have. But say we had it, how much media do you think would be produced? I mean, you're still not solving some of the critical problems about media production. And that's my point, is that there's a gap between what the technology where it's at today and just the creativity side, the part of inspiring people to participate, to use these tools. You know, when I was 5, I learned how to use cursive and practiced handwriting, right? We need to have kids who are 5 learning how to edit video and watch TV critically. I mean, that's where it has to start at a young age so that the language the linguistics of video evolve and start to become cohesive and allow people to communicate effectively. Until then, you know, people will just be ripping off the same. If you look at student films, right? Basically, student films for the most part are replications of professional Hollywood films done with low budgets. And you can't do low budget versions of professional Hollywood films because those films are all about the money, about the glamour, about the quality of the imagery, or the star factor. You know, you look at great independent films.
Well, they're also about the special effects, and they're also about the technical abilities, and that is getting cheaper, right?
Well, I'm including that in the imagery, and it is getting cheaper.
That can be done, though. I mean, with Final Cut.
But it can never be done as good as someone who has $100 million.
They're always going to stay a couple steps ahead.
But yeah, but there's areas where they can't stay ahead. And that's the point, is independent media, what it has that Hollywood doesn't have is it has the freedom. It doesn't have to deal with censorship necessarily, doesn't have to deal with the FCC, doesn't have to deal with commercialism, capitalism necessarily.
Investor risk.
But you can make films that have high quality people and stories, that have realistic situations, real interesting just relationships, communities, whatever it is.
Right.
That's something that Hollywood can't do.
Right, that doesn't cost anything.
And that's what independent media makers have. Yeah. That's the one thing we have that nobody else has. And so there has to be a focus on doing that, on building up, you know, people. I think that needs to, there still hasn't been a mainstream, even a small stream movement towards making films like that. There is the Dogma 95 movement, I don't know if anyone knows about that, with films like The Celebration. Lars von Trier was involved with that. That was a commercial version of what I'm talking about, but... Anyone, let's see what's going on. Collaborative. All right, Jay Dedman's asking, what about tools that encourage collaborative video making?
That's what we're talking about.
Let's give an example of collaborative video making, all right? Let's think Wikipedia, but for video, right? So I have this project that I'm going to hopefully do sometime in the near future called a dictionary, as in addiction, but the dictionary. And the idea is just simply A to Z, they're your problem, something like that. And people can contribute things that have to do with addiction, whether it's their own or their families or their friends, and they can put it in a certain letter. So the addiction could be love, and then people might have addictions that have an L or an O or a V or an E. And the idea is just creating this great, vast library and database of highly annotated media that has to do with, everything has to do with addiction. People can add a small clip that has to do with it, they can edit, they can pull things, they can make playlists out of it, or they can edit new packages out of it. That's a non-linear playground for participatory media. It's an example of a situation where there's not necessarily a linear product, digital content product that's going to come out of it. Rather, there's an experience one can have a couple times a week or maybe every day when they're walking around with their digital camera. They have a place to put what they're doing, or something to think about while they're shooting that might mean something to them or to their family or their friends. And that's an example of collaborative.
What needs to happen before something like that becomes easily available, easily done? And or why haven't you done it before?
Well, it involves a few things. Number one, I mean, I still believe it's going to take something in terms of a IT-based camcorder, or at least desktop-based software that helps with the capture of the video and the creation of useful metadata. Because without that, the people who would want to participate in this sort of environment aren't going to participate. There's just a gap between, if I want to just shoot a little clip of video with my camera phone and be involved in this sort of thing, I'm not going to sit there and type for 15 minutes and upload and wait, etc. It has to be natural. It has to be part of the social interaction.
So is the next generation of media built on game engines?
I think so. I don't know if it's built on game engines, but... Kenyatta just asked, is the next generation of media built on game engines? I would say definitely something like that. The cinema of the 21st century is gaming. Cinema was 20th century. 21st century is more like gaming. And you have a situation where you've got interactivity, you've got participation, you've got persistent worlds, and it's non-linear. There's not necessarily a goal to make something that's 30 minutes long. And I don't know about exactly the game engines, but if you look at Flickr, you know, they've evolved out of a game engine, Game Never Ending. And That's critical to understand. They built something for gaming, and then they created this photo sharing environment. That's key. That's a good sign. And they just got investment announced from Esther Dyson and Joe Ito and a few other people.
Yeah, I heard about that. So, hi everybody, I'm Sean Van Every. I've been sort of behind the scenes here running the camera and trying to make this stream work. So I apologize for all of the hiccups. To Eli's point about the game engines, I don't think that game engines are really the end-all be-all of the participatory media, but I think that game engines are the only thing that's close to what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think that we can take a lot from what they're doing in the gaming world to get people to participate and get people to interact with each other and make it a more social and participatory
and natural
type of thing. Mm. Games have the added, you know, competition and points and things like that, which I don't think is necessarily required for interactive media. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's one thing we have to be a little bit careful when we say game engines and not bring in the competitive nature or that type of thing and just talk about how it gets people to lean forward instead of leaning back and still enjoy and participate and all that kind of stuff.
Jade has asked, where is our place in this? We're going to come back to that in a second, Jade. I just want to comment on something Sean just said. So, except I don't know if you have sound, so we'll just keep talking and see what happens.
Here, Sean, okay?
Sean, I just want to say that I don't think it's a problem to be afraid of using points or game engine, that type of metaphor, because it's a stepping stone. So you can't necessarily get to what we're talking about without maybe just imitating a game first and then moving forward from there. And there's no reason to limit it to just not gaming. I think gaming can be part of it, and then something else can be part of it, and there'll be all sorts of things that come out of it. But I think Flickr is a good example, too. It's not gaming, but it's a social playground for the tagging and sharing of images, and it's working really well.
Right, right. Oh, I agree. So we're wrapping up in about 2 minutes, so let's talk a little bit about the next show.
We want to get back to Jay's... Well, Jay asked, what is our place in this? And let's talk about that in the context of the next show. Our place in this is to make this happen. It's to find the people who can help make it happen, find the companies, the technology that's critical to it, the creative people that are critical to it, and solve little pieces of it as we go, trying it out and building a community around these things.
Jay, can you actually join us next week and be our guest and we'll go from there? So we'll wait for Jay's response, and we'll talk a little bit about the future of the Unmediated Weekly Show, which is we're going to continue here from DBA in the East Village of New York, and we're going to bring in guests and people to talk to and interview that would be interesting. Okay, so Jay's going to be here next week to our audience, and we'll grill them, and we'll let them talk about what they're working on, and we'll go from there. And so hopefully, This is a show for you that we're putting on, and we find it fascinating and interesting, and we're going to continue to improve the technology. And Eli really wants to say something,
I'm
going to let him talk.
Jay, why don't we make it a point for next week, and we'll see what people think about this, but let's talk next week about creative solutions to participatory media. Nothing having to do with technology necessarily, unless it's essential to what we're talking about. Talk about ways that we can inspire people to use video cameras and video and annotate video and share and edit video that are natural, that are social, and that help build up the need for new technology. Because one of the problems here is, who knows what to build if no one's asking for
it? And the consumers need to start asking for it. Now, and I want to stress that we don't want to call people consumers anymore. We want to call them the participants. And I want to get away from this sort of consumer-oriented media production point of view and move into, you know, what the world is really like, which is we're all participants, and the media should be that way as well. And so we'll see y'all next week. And any comments or questions on the show, feel free to comment in the blog entry on unmediated.org.
Or email at theweeklyshow@unmediated.org.
Great.
Send it off. This is Sean Van Avery over here.
Hello.
On his ITJ system. You can look it up at walking-productions.com/ITJ. And this is Eli Chapman from Unmediated signing out.
Bye-bye.